Everything is quiet and still in the forest. A gentle breeze rustles leaves and branches. Nesting birds squawk to one another. A hedgehog snuffles in a bark pile, looking for something good to eat. Somewhere, a woodpecker drills its beak into a tree trunk. It's a peaceful summer's day in the heart of an English woodland, in the year 1236, 21 years into Henry III's reign. Then something disturbs the peace. It's the noise of men beating a path between the trees. Heavy feet tramp along. Gruff voices call to one another, joking and laughing. Ropes scratch as they're dragged through the undergrowth. A grumpy donkey brays as its driver flicks it with a stick. It's a team of woodcutters. One of many, in fact. They've been sent out into this forest with a job to do, and urgent instructions to get on with it. Some of the trees here have stood for hundreds of years. Now they've got to come down. It's the boss's orders. That boss is Richard, Earl of Cornwall, younger brother of the Plantagenet King of England, Henry III. Other than the king, Richard is the wealthiest bloke in the land. What he says goes. So now the woodcutters settle in front of a large tree, and for a moment the forest falls quiet. Then with a grunt and a heave, the first of them swings an axe and brings it thudding into the side of the trunk. Soon enough, a drumbeat of axe blows has turned this tranquil patch of wood into a cacophony. After that, it's not long before the first trees start to fall, their thick trunks screaming as they totter over sideways and their branches raking an ugly path to the ground. Richard has ordered that hundreds of acres of his woodlands must be chopped down and the timber sold off to raise money. Why? Because Richard, like more than one of his Plantagenet forebears, has decided that he's going on crusade. That's right, crusade. The holy wars that have torn up the eastern Mediterranean and many other parts of Europe besides have been going for nearly 150 years now. And even though they've hardly been a rousing success, there's no sign that they're going to ease up anytime soon. The Christian world's latest pariah is the Sultan of Egypt, who goes by the name of Al-Kamil. Al-Kamil is the nephew of Richard the Lionheart's old sparring partner, Saladin. He's every bit as politically savvy as his late uncle, and arguably much cleverer to boot. He's recently faced down the warriors of the Fifth Crusade, who tried to attack him in Cairo, but got nowhere near before half of them caught dysentery and the other half were drowned or eaten by crocodiles in the Nile. But that hasn't put Europe's noblemen off the idea of having another go at him. For 10 years, there's been a truce between the Christians of the Holy Land and Al-Kamil's Egypt. But this is due to expire in 1239. And when that happens, there'll be plenty for vigorous 27-year-old warriors like Richard to get stuck into. Hence the trees being chopped down, to raise the cash reserves he's going to need in the east. Yet Richard's good old-fashioned desire to smite the infidel is not the only reason he's cashing in on his woodlands and looking to get the heck out of England for a while. Truth be told, he could do with a break from it all. Richard's brother, Henry III, is nearly 30 years old now, and he's been king ever since he was 9. But he's not turning out to be very well suited to the job. He's pliable, easily influenced, and naive. He's a nice chap, and notably pious. He loves architecture, collects relics, and is a keen visitor to holy shrines. But that's not really the be-all and end-all when it comes to being king. Since childhood, Henry's been overawed by a series of ministers who have manipulated him to get rich quick. Richard hasn't been above a bit of manipulation, truth be told, but as the years pass, there seems to be more competition to control the king than ever before. Time after time, new men and women will turn up at the English court, and you can bet your life that one way or another, they all want a piece of Henry. Some of them are well-meaning and capable, but too many others of them are chancers, who see Henry as an easy target. And one or two of them are truly dangerous. Unscrupulous and ambitious individuals who will stop at nothing to use the weak-minded king to get their own way. Richard can see which way the wind is blowing, which is why he's already making plans for a crusade that won't get going for a couple of years. He's smart enough to know that there will come a time when he needs to get out of England, even if that means taking his chances fighting the Sultan of Egypt. Slowly but surely, England is turning into a powder keg, and Richard has no desire to be there when it finally explodes. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 3, The In-Laws. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. The very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. Even in the short time we've known Henry III this season, I think we've all concluded, like his brother Richard has, that this Plantagenet is a bit of a pushover. And that's a problem. In the Middle Ages, a strong king knows that he's always going to be surrounded by a certain number of courtiers trying to sponge off him, and will regulate his court accordingly. Sadly, Henry isn't a strong king. Now and again, he will realise that he's being taken advantage of by someone, throw his toys out of the pram and try to get a grip on his reign by himself, but he doesn't do it often, and typically he doesn't do it for long. He's a bit like what in dating terms you'd call a serial monogamist. He'd prefer to be in a 6 out of 10 relationship than face going to the movies on his own. But don't just take my word for it. Listen to this for a political psychological car crash. Where we left our story last time, Henry was more or less joined at the hip to one of his and Richard's dad's friends, a veteran baron and administrator called Hubert de Burgh. Hubert, as you'll recall, runs England like he's a second king. And thanks to his dominant relationship with Henry, he also gets filthy rich. But eventually, Hubert pushes his luck too far. Yes, he's been laden down with titles, lands, castles, and financial favours as rewards for his competent handling of royal government. But he's also made a lot of enemies. And in 1232, a bishop called Peter de Roche manages to get into Henry's ear and turn him against his favourite. Now, this is the same Peter de Roche who was Henry's official guardian when he was a small boy. Since the rise of Hubert de Burgh, Peter's been away on crusade. It really is the hot trend of the mid-13th century. In fact, Peter hasn't just been on crusade. He's been hanging out with the most powerful man in Europe, the German Emperor Frederick II Hohenstaufen. Anyway, now he's back, and Henry's remembering just how much he's always liked him. Ostentatious piety, plus an appetite for fighting, which Henry personally lacks. This Plantagenet is just a sucker for it. By the summer of 1232, Peter finally persuades Henry that Hubert has been manipulating him, and Henry is furious. Henry strips Hubert of a whole swathe of the lands and titles he has amassed during his own spell as chief royal handholder. Then he puts him on trial for corruption and throws him in jail. But don't breathe a sigh of relief just yet, because having ejected that serial manipulator from his life, Henry then immediately makes exactly the same mistake. In place of Hubert, Peter de Roche now takes over as royal favourite. Surprise, surprise, just like Hubert, Peter runs the government as he sees fit, feathering his own nest with the proceeds of power. And surprise, surprise, Peter in turn proves very objectionable to a number of leading English barons, some of whom start trying to work up a rebellion against him. By 1234, Peter is also out on his ear, and has fled England under a cloud. It's kind of exhausting even thinking about it, and you can see why in 1236 Henry's brother Richard has had enough of it all, and is packing his bags and prepping for a crusade. But that same year, there's a big moment in Henry's life that ushers in a new dimension to his reign. It begins when he gets married. The wedding takes place in Westminster Abbey on January the 20th, 1236, in a ceremony conducted by the Archbishop of Canterbury. On the surface of it, this is one of those typical Plantagenet whirlwind romances. By which I mean, Henry's 28 and his bride is roughly 12 or 13 years old. They've only met once before, 6 days earlier to be precise, when they were formally betrothed. And the marriage has far more to do with Henry's desire to ally the Plantagenets with some other influential dynasties than it has to do with any sappy romantic ideals like love, or raising a happy family, or pottering around IKEA on a Saturday afternoon looking for some new wardrobes. Yet, as it happens, Henry lucks out. His new wife, called Eleanor of Provence, will grow up to be one of the most astute, politically savvy, and level-headed queens England ever has. She'll be devoted to Henry and will stick with him through some pretty ropey times. What's more, she brings with her a bunch of in-laws who provide Henry with a bit of political direction after many years of drift. They're known collectively as the Savoyards, after Eleanor's mother, whose family comes from Savoy, now in northern Italy. And they sweep through England like a new broom. The most important of these Savoyards is one of Eleanor's uncles, a guy called William of Savoy. He's a bishop and a brilliant administrator and diplomat. He's the don of the family. Not only has he married Eleanor to the King of England, he's also fixed it for her sister to marry the King of France, Louis IX. From his arrival in 1236, William of Savoy takes a grip on English government. At first, it looks like he's going to be this year's Hubert de Burgh or Peter de Roche. He dazzles Henry with his brilliance, grabs hold of the levers of power, and uses his proximity to the crown to start arranging good marriages for his relatives. Except, what William of Savoy doesn't do is abuse Henry's good nature in the way that Hubert and Peter did. Because, well, he doesn't need to. His niece is already the queen, and William himself has an independent income from his bishopric in southern France. So rather than treating his dominant position at court as a private carriage on the Plantagenet gravy train, William of Savoy actually devotes the bulk of his attention to getting England working properly. He runs the rule over Henry's tight finances. He sacks corrupt sheriffs. He oversees long overdue reforms to the legal system, and he reissues Magna Carta, again. He pushes Henry to take the lead in government rather than traipsing along in his shadow. It's during William's spell at Henry's side that the first ever English Parliament is held in 1237. It doesn't look a lot like a modern Parliament, but the basic elements are in place. It's a meeting of nobles and possibly some knights who agree to new laws in exchange for granting tax. Looking back, it'll come to be seen as a seismic moment in English history. And if you want to hear more about why, check out this week's bonus episode on This Is History Plus. In short, in 1236, Henry doesn't just marry a young girl who will grow into a whip-smart queen. He gets a first-rate consigliere at his court as part of the deal. But hold on, I hear you say. Didn't I tell you about 10 minutes ago that in the mid-1230s Henry's court is infiltrated with some really nasty pieces of work? Well, yes, I did. And it's them we have to turn to now. Because just as the Queen's uncle, William of Savoy, is getting Plantagenet government working properly, someone else is about to join the royal family who will end up smashing the whole thing into tiny pieces. His name is Simon de Montfort, and his story also starts with a wedding. On January the 7th, 1238, in a tiny chapel in the corner of Henry's chamber in Westminster Palace, an excited couple stand before a royal chaplain to take their wedding vows. The chapel is in a pretty sorry state. Henry's waiting to have new floor tiles laid in there, and they won't be ready till next month. But this isn't supposed to be a grand wedding. There are few, if any, guests. The couple whisper their way through their vows, part nervous and part excited. They're in love. They're thrilled to be getting hitched. But they're also very aware that they're getting married in secret. Barely anyone knows it's happening. Just them, the chaplain, and the man who's given them permission to get hitched in the corner of his bedroom, King Henry III. They know that once the wedding is done, there are going to be some unhappy campers at the Plantagenet court. That's because the groom is 29-year-old Simon de Montfort, who's been creeping his way relentlessly into royal favour for the last few years. The bride is Henry's 22-year-old sister, Eleanor. Now, marrying the king's sister is kind of a big deal in any age. Henry's had three sisters, and the other two have married big. The eldest, Joan, tied the knot with the King of Scotland. The second, Isabella, recently married the most powerful man in Europe, the extraordinary Frederick II Hohenstaufen, who's Holy Roman Emperor, King of Germany, Italy, Sicily, and Jerusalem. Eleanor, the youngest sister, was married to one of the great knight William Marshall's sons when she was a little girl. She was widowed, aged 16, and took a vow of chastity. Now she's not only breaking that vow, she's also using up a valuable diplomatic marriage credit on the man who happens to be flavour of the month with her big brother, the king. How's this happening? Well, the simple truth is that she adores Simon. He adores the idea of being married to a princess, and they've both worked on Henry for long enough that he's let them do what they want. The trouble is, not for the first time, Henry has let his easygoing nature get in the way of smart politics. Basically, if he likes someone, he's usually inclined to let them have their own way. And he really likes Simon de Montfort. It's not hard to see why, if you know Henry. Simon's come from a tough family in the French South. His dad was a brutal and effective leader of the crusade against the heretic Cathars. Or at least, he was until he was hit by a random stone thrown from a trebuchet operated by a team of women in the city of Toulouse, which crushed his skull and killed him on the spot. Simon has inherited his dad's military skill, and allied it with a silver tongue and incredible personal charisma. He comes over to England to lay claim to his family inheritance, chiefly the Earldom of Leicester. But once he gets to the English court, he finds there's more than that on offer, if he can lay a bit of his razzle-dazzle charm on the king. Which turns out to be not that difficult. Simon's very pious, another big tick for Henry. He's got that claim to be Earl of Leicester, so he's a legitimate member of the English aristocracy. The best contemporary likeness we have of him, from his official seal, shows a strong, long-limbed athlete charging across the countryside on the back of a beautifully tacked horse with a hunting horn raised to his lips. He's got a twinkle in his eye and the gift of the gab. What more do you need? In Henry's eyes, nothing. Simon quickly smooth-talks his way into the king's inner circle, and in no time, he's attending meetings of the Great Council, helping out with foreign diplomacy, and even organising the party for the king's wedding. So when Simon's big break comes, his own marriage to the king's sister, it feels to them like the next step in a budding friendship. Unfortunately, Henry and Simon aren't the only ones who have a stake in all this. Barons expect to be consulted on big political marriages, which Eleanor's definitely is, and to get an invite to the ceremony. The church expects vows of chastity to be observed. Henry's brother Richard, still waiting to go on crusade, expects to have a say in who their little sis jumps into bed with. So when news of Simon's secret marriage to Eleanor gets out, it causes major ructions at court and beyond. Richard well and truly loses his you-know-what. And as he has in the past, he starts making very rebellious-sounding moves. First, Richard allies with Gilbert Marshall, the most powerful surviving son of the great knight William Marshall, whose family feel very insulted that Eleanor has broken her vow of chastity. The two of them start holding armed rallies with other nobles and knights around southern England and in the city of London. Things get so sketchy that Henry has to lock himself in the Tower of London for a week, while his wife's uncle, William of Savoy, knocks heads together and draws up a settlement between the livid Richard and the smug Simon de Montfort. Thanks to the calm head of Uncle Willie, and the fact that now Simon and Eleanor are married, they can't be unmarried without causing a major headache, the crisis is diffused. Simon heads off to Rome to get the Pope's license for his marriage and lets everyone calm down while he's away. Henry gives Richard a huge chunk of cash towards his crusade fund. By the end of the year 1238, a sort of peace has been restored. Richard is looking forward to getting out to the Holy Land and having a charge at the infidel, rather than his impossible brother. Simon de Montfort and Eleanor are celebrating the birth of their first child, a boy, whom they have the good sense to name Henry after the king. Even better, at Christmas that year, Henry's young queen, Eleanor of Provence, announces that she too is pregnant with their first child. This is the best news Henry could have hoped for. He'll have been on the throne 20 years in 1239, and an heir to the Plantagenet crown, who isn't his headstrong brother Richard, is something he's been sorely lacking. In June 1239, Queen Eleanor gives birth to a son. They name the boy Edward. It's a weird Saxon name for a child born to the Plantagenets, who've leaned so heavily into French names like Henry, Richard, Geoffrey, and John. But trendy name or not, it's a huge step for Henry III. Now he has an immediate family to go along with his large extended one. But as usual with the Plantagenets, good news doesn't last for long. Within 6 weeks of little Edward's birth, another huge row has blown up at court. Once again, Simon de Montfort is at its heart, and it's the start of a slow disintegration of his relationship with Henry that will end up with the two of them, and little Edward, locked in a struggle to the death. All that's for next time on This Is History. If you can't wait for more Plantagenet action, a reminder that the next episode is already out over on This Is History Plus, where you can listen ad-free alongside hours of subscriber-only content, where I chat with my producer about the Middle Ages. This week, we discuss Plantagenet naming conventions. To subscribe, go to Apple Podcasts and click Try Free, or head to thisishistorypod.com to start your free trial today.